Why did Donald Trump follow Barack Obama into the White House? Why is America so polarized? How does American exceptionalism explain these social changes? In his new book, Exceptional America, Mugambi Jue describes why Americans are far more divided than other Westerners over basic issues, including wealth inequality, healthcare, climate change, evolution, gender roles, and the death penalty, just to name a few. Raised in Paris by a French mother and a Kenyan father, Jue then lived in the Bible Belt, Manhattan, and beyond. Drawing inspiration from de Tocqueville, he wields his multicultural sensibility to parse how the intense polarization of U.S. conservatives and liberals has become, he believes, a key dimension of American exceptionalism, an idea widely misunderstood as American superiority. Again, the name of the book is Exceptional America. Mugambi Jue is Thomas C. Gray Fellow at Stanford Law School and author of the new book, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
What brought you to the subject of looking at these divisions?
My book aims to answer three fundamental questions. How did America go from Barack Obama to Donald Trump? Why is America so intensely polarized? And how is it explained by American exceptionalism? And what I argue in my book is that the extraordinary polarization of modern America is a dimension of what American exceptionalism has historically meant, which is that America is an exception, for better or worse, compared to other Western democracies, because Americans are routinely clashing over a broad range of issues that are either not controversial or much less controversial elsewhere in the Western world, such as access to health care, abortion, or gun control.
So how did we get here in the sense of, is this a recent phenomenon or have these seeds been planted a long time ago?
It's part of a long-term evolution in American society. First of all, there are many unique dimensions of American history, politics, law, culture, economic attitudes, race relations, religious beliefs, foreign policy, and beyond that have shaped unique problems, unique ways of looking at things that tend to distinguish America from other Western democracies, that is, European nations, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, and sometimes from the rest of the entire world as well. But also, this is part of an evolution within conservative America within the last 30 years, a phenomenon that political scientists call asymmetric polarization, which is that over the last 30 years, the Republican Party has moved drastically more to the right than the Democratic Party has moved to the left. And that calls into question the notion of both sidesism, that in today's America, both sides are just as extreme and radical that is not supported by empirical evidence. And in my book, I look at a number of different factors behind this long-term evolution, drawing upon the roots of American exceptionalism and connecting that to Donald Trump's election, including the weight of anti-intellectualism in parts of American society, the weight of Christian fundamentalism, of radical anti-governmentalism, and also of racial resentment.
Talk a little bit about your multicultural background and the lens that provides you to look at these shifts.
Well, unlike Barack Obama, I was actually born in Kenya. My father is Kenyan. My mother is French, from Brittany, the Celtic region of France. And after being born in Nairobi, I grew up in Paris in a very multicultural environment, not very far from the Eiffel Tower, speaking French with my mom and English with my dad. But my roots are in America, in a sense, because my parents had met in New York City when they were international students at Columbia. Eventually, I decided to move to the United States for college, going from Paris, France, not to Paris, Texas, but to Houston, Texas, at Rice University, and I had a chance to live in the Bible Belt before ultimately moving to New York City, also spending time in New England, in Chicago, and now in the Bay Area. And what struck me was not only the vast contrast between America as a whole and France and other Western nations, but also the huge contrasts within the United States. And that may seem obvious at first. We've always known that there's a major regional divide in American society that was, of course, a big part of the reason behind the Civil War and the clash over slavery. But what people tend to overlook is that if you leave Paris for rural regions of France, yes, you might meet people who are more conservative, but you won't meet people who widely think that universal health care is a tyranny of socialized medicine, who think that abortion is one of the greatest evils that the world has ever known, that everyone should have the right to carry a gun, and that climate change is a hoax, whereas these types of beliefs are quite common in conservative regions of the United States, in red states in particular.
You mentioned a moment ago about exploring anti-intellectualism and really how it came to a surface in the 2016 presidential contest in this country. You start off a chapter entitled From the American Enlightenment to Anti-Intellectualism with a quote from Donald Trump, who asks, "How stupid are the people of Iowa?" Give us a sense of how that idea of people in, let's say, rural areas in our country are perceived by others, and how true that is, and what it ultimately brings us into the equation of anti-intellectualism.
Well, actually, the state of Iowa was not only a pioneer in America, but also internationally in developing access to primary and secondary education in the 19th century. And that's a reflection of some of the contradictions of American society. So on one hand, America has great universities, and also it has a great intellectual tradition that I describe as part of my discussion of the American Enlightenment. That is that America's founding fathers were extraordinarily intellectually curious men. They were very well educated. Some, like Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin, engaged in scientific experiments. But nonetheless, after the age of the founding fathers, there was also the rise of a populist conception of democracy that started equating education with elitism. And that fostered a notion that common sense was just good enough to understand politics, to make money, and that people really didn't need education. This could be simply indifference towards education, but oftentimes it also was a downright hostility towards intellectual life. And we see that these are the roots of the anti-intellectualism of political figures like Donald Trump. But also, it's well worth noting that the phenomenon did not start with him, even though it intensified during the 2016 presidential election. There are many other examples I provide in my book, such as the views of George W. Bush, of Sarah Palin, of John Boehner, suggesting that they don't really value education.
Let me ask you a question that will just bring us into a brief diversion, although not really, which is that you specifically are looking at America and the exceptional America, and yet we're in a time where we are seeing sharp divisions throughout our world. We saw this with Brexit, we're perhaps seeing this in France, and we're seeing it elsewhere in the world. So how does what we are seeing of the division of America's of Americans from the world and from each other, of how that is being mirrored across the globe?
So on one hand, it's true that there are similar movements in America and other parts of the Western world, as illustrated by Brexit and the rise of far-right European parties. But what I explain in my book is that there are many more sources and forces of polarization in America. So in Europe, the two main sources of polarization are, on one hand, the anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim, and nativist sentiment, and on the other hand, hostility towards the European Union. But the two are intertwined because the European Union is accused of opening up borders, enabling immigration, and undermining national sovereignty. And both immigrants and the EU are scapegoated for the problems of European nations. And we see some of the same things in America with the rise of Donald Trump's openly anti-immigrant and nativist movement, and also resentment towards the Washington establishment that evokes resentment towards the European Union. That being said, there are many more sources and forces of polarization in America, and Americans are clashing over a broad range of issues that are not divisive or much less divisive elsewhere in the Western world, such as whether people should have a basic right to health care, whether special interests should be allowed to spend unlimited money on political campaigns and on lobbying, whether climate change is a hoax or scientific reality, whether women should have a right to abortion, whether contraception should be covered by people's health insurance, whether to teach abstinence-only sex education or comprehensive sex education in public schools, whether to teach creationism or the theory of evolution in public schools, whether people should have an unbridled right to bear arms, whether to have the death penalty, whether to have mass incarceration on a scale not only unprecedented in American history, but also unprecedented in the history of humankind, whether it's appropriate to resort to torture in the war on terror. These types of issues are quite atypical by international standards, but they're really at the heart of the U.S. Legal, political, and social debate, and that's one big difference with the evolution in Western Europe these days.
How do you believe that the issues that you write about in the book would have been different under a Clinton administration? And ultimately, where are we now, since we don't have a Clinton administration, we have a Trump administration?
Well, it's hard to foresee how things could have played out if Hillary Clinton had been elected. That being said, it probably would have been a continuation in many ways of what happened during the Obama presidency. So Hillary Clinton vowed to essentially build upon Obama's program and essentially try to, for example, expand access to health care, improve environmental regulation, et cetera. And we also probably would have seen continued relentless opposition and obstructionism from the Republican Party if Hillary Clinton had been elected. What we would not have seen would have been the magnitude of the anti-intellectualism, conspiracy mongering, incompetence, peculiarities that have characterized the Trump administration's first 100 days. And also, we probably wouldn't have seen the quite peculiar redefinition of U.S. foreign policy, such as the rapprochement with Russia and the embrace of some dictators like Duterte in the Philippines, which have shocked human rights experts.
So what do you think those characteristics that you just talked about of the Trump administration, where do you think that brings us over the long term, not just 100 days, but a four-year term?
It's hard to make predictions, especially about the future, as the popular saying goes. But overall, there are two main possible outcomes. On one hand, it's possible that there's going to be a major backlash against the Trump administration, which may cost the Republican Party seats in Congress during the midterm elections, and which would jeopardize its chances of winning back the White House. That being said, it's also possible that Donald Trump's rhetoric and style will become normalized. And even though today he has quite low approval ratings by historical standards, it's important to note that according to Gallup's data, he has an 87% approval rating among Republicans, which suggests that, in fact, many Republicans find his rhetoric and his quite radical agenda acceptable, and that they either embrace some of his ideas, such as his birther conspiracy theories about Obama's allegedly forged U.S. birth certificate, which incidentally would mean that Obama himself is an undocumented immigrant, because if you have a forged birth certificate, you're not documented. Or say his ban on Muslims, which was proposed during his presidential campaign, and which has been implemented to an extent through executive orders. His high approval ratings among Republicans suggest that a substantial proportion either support these types of ideas or don't find them particularly troubling, and therefore this normalization of Trumpism might definitely lead to perhaps the Republican Party staying in power. But there's also long-term evolutions that may come into the picture that actually are perhaps tied to Trump's rise. So it's expected that by 2050, whites might no longer be the majority of the U.S. population, and therefore this would jeopardize any politician or movement that is very nativist or anti-immigrant or anti-minority in its rhetoric. And also there's a generational shift where young Americans, even though they tend to be quite religious in many cases, they are less drawn to fundamentalist conceptions of Christianity, such as with regard to gay rights. And this may undermine the religious rights movement that is a big part of Trump's coalition.
Mugambi Jue, teachers at Stanford Law School. The new book is Exceptional America, What Divides Americans from the World and from Each Other. The book is published by the University of California Press. Mugambi Jue, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
The pleasure was all mine.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Exceptional America. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.